The sheriff turned back to Jay. The niggers may be concealing her. We've brought dogs. Jay waved a generous hand. Go ahead and do whatever you need to. We should search the house, too. Mac caught his breath. He had been hoping they would not think that necessary. Jay frowned. It's not likely the child is in here. Still, for the sake of thoroughness... Jay hesitated, and Mac hoped he would get on his high horse and tell the sheriff to go to hell. But after a moment he shrugged and said, Of course. Mac's heart sank. Jay went on, There's only my wife and me in residence. The rest of the place is empty, but search everywhere. By all means, I'll leave you to it. He closed his door. Barton said to Mac, Which is Mrs. Jamison's room? Mac swallowed. Next door. He stepped along the landing and knocked gently. With his heart in his mouth, he said, Mrs. Jamison, are you awake? There was a pause, then Lizzie opened the door. Feigning sleepiness, she said, What on earth do you want at this hour? The sheriff is looking for a fugitive. Lizzie opened the door wide. Well, I haven't got one in here. Mac looked into the room, wondering where Peg was hiding. Barton said, May we step inside for a moment? There was an almost imperceptible flash of fear in Lizzie's eyes, and Mac wondered whether Barton had seen it. Lizzie shrugged with a semblance of apathy and said, Feel free? The two men stepped inside, looking awkward. Lizzie let her dressing gown sag open a little, as if by accident. Mac could not help looking at the way the nightdress draped her rounded breasts. The other two men reacted with the same reflex. Lizzie looked the sheriff in the eye, and he turned away guiltily. She was deliberately making them feel uncomfortable, so that they would search hastily. The sheriff lay on the floor and looked under the bed, while his assistant opened the wardrobe. Lizzie sat on the bed. With a hasty gesture, she picked up a corner of the bedspread and tugged it. Mac glimpsed a small, dirty foot for a split second before it was covered up. Peg was in the bed. She was so thin that she hardly made a bulge in the piled-up covers. The sheriff opened a blanket chest, and the other man looked behind a screen. There were not many places to check. Would they pull the covers off the bed? The same thought must have gone through Lizzie's mind, for she said, Now, if you're done, I'm going back to sleep. And she got into bed. Barton looked hard at Lizzie and the bed. Did he have the nerve to demand that Lizzie get out again? But he did not really think the master and mistress of the house were concealing the murderess. He was searching the place only to be comfortable about eliminating the possibility. After a moment's hesitation, he said, Thank you, Mrs. Jamison. We're sorry to have disturbed your rest. We'll carry on and search the slave quarters. Mac felt weak with relief. He held the door for them, hiding his jubilation. Good luck, Lizzie said. And Sheriff, when you've finished your work, bring your men back here to the house and have some breakfast. Chapter 34 Lizzie stayed in her room while the men and dogs searched the plantation. She and Peg talked in low voices, and Peg told her the story of her life. Lizzie was horrified and shaken. Peg was just a girl, thin and pretty and cheeky. Lizzie's dead baby had been a girl. They exchanged dreams. Lizzie revealed that she wanted to live out of doors and wear men's clothing and spend all day on horseback with a gun. Peg took a folded and worn sheet of paper from inside her chemise. It was a hand-coloured picture showing a father, a mother, and a child standing outside a pretty cottage in the country.
"I always wanted to be the little girl in the picture," she said. "But now sometimes I want to be the mother."
At the usual time, Sarah, the cook, came to the room with Lizzie's breakfast on a tray. Peg hid under the bedclothes at her knock, but the woman walked in and said to Lizzie,
"I know all about Peggy, so don't you worry."
Peggy came out again, and Lizzie said bemusedly,
"Who doesn't know?"
"Mr. Jamison and Mr. Lennox."
Lizzie shared her breakfast with Peg. The child shoveled down grilled ham and scrambled eggs, as if she had not eaten for a month. The search party left as she was finishing. Lizzie and Peg went to the window and watched the men cross the lawn and make their way down to the river. They were disappointed and subdued, walking with slumped shoulders, and the dogs, picking up the mood, trailed obediently behind. They watched the men out of sight, then Lizzie sighed with relief and said,
"You're safe."
They hugged happily. Peg was painfully bony, and Lizzie felt a surge of maternal feeling for the poor child. Peg said,
I'm always safe with Mac. You'll have to stay in this room until we're sure Jay and Lennox are out of the way.
Aren't you worried that Mr. Jamieson will come in?
Peg asked. No, he never comes in here. Peg looked puzzled, but she did not ask any more questions. Instead, she said,
When I'm older, I'm going to marry Mac.
Lizzie had the strangest feeling that she was being warned off. Mac sat in the old nursery, where he could be sure he would not be disturbed, going through his survival kit. He had a stolen ball of twine and 6 hooks, made for him by the blacksmith Cass, so that he could catch fish. He had a tin cup and plate of the kind given to slaves. There was a tinder box so he could light fires, and an iron pan to cook his food. He had an axe and a heavy knife he had purloined while the slaves were felling trees and making barrels. At the bottom of the bag, wrapped in a scrap of linen, was a key to the gun room. His last act before leaving would be to steal a rifle and ammunition. Also in the canvas bag were his copy of Robinson Crusoe and the iron collar he had brought from Scotland. He picked up the collar, remembering how he had broken it in the smithy the night he had escaped from Hugh. He recalled how he had danced a jig of freedom in the moonlight. More than a year later, he was still not free, but he had not given up. Peg's return had removed the last obstacle preventing him running away from Mockjack Hall. She had moved into the slave quarters and slept in a hut of single girls. They would all keep her secret. They would always protect one of their own. It was not the first time a fugitive had been hidden in the quarters. Any runaway could get a bowl of hominy and a hard bed for the night at every plantation in Virginia. During the day she roamed the woods, keeping out of sight until darkness fell. Then she returned to the quarters to eat with the hands. Mac knew this could not go on for long. Soon boredom would make her careless and she would be caught. But she would not have to live that way for many days. Mac's skin tingled with anticipation. Cora was married, Peg was saved, and the map had shown him where he had to go. Freedom was his heart's desire. As soon as they chose, he and Peg could simply walk away from the plantation at the end of the day's work. By dawn, they could be 30 miles away. They would hide during the hours of daylight, then go on at night. Like all runaways, they would beg food at the slave quarters of the nearest plantation every morning and evening. Unlike most runaways, Mac would not try to get a job as soon as he had gone 100 miles. That was how they were always caught. He was going farther away. His destination was the wilderness beyond the mountains. There he would be free. But Peg had been back a week, and he was still at Mockjack Hall. He stared at his map and his fish hooks and his tinderbox. He was a step away from freedom, but he could not take that step. He had fallen in love with Lizzie, and he could not bear to leave her. Lizzie stood naked in front of the cheval glass in her bedroom, looking at her body. She had told Jay she was back to normal after the pregnancy, but the truth was that she would never be quite the same. Her breasts had gone back to their previous size, but they were not as firm, and they seemed to hang a little lower on her chest. Her tummy would never return to normal, she now realized. The slight bulge and the slackness of the skin were with her forever. She had faint silvery lines where her skin had stretched. They had faded, but not completely, and she had a feeling they would always be there. Down below, the place where the baby came out was also different. It had once been so tight that she could hardly get a finger in. That, too, had stretched. She wondered if this was why Jay no longer wanted her. He had not seen her naked body since the birth, but perhaps he knew what it was like, or guessed, and found it disgusting. Felia, his slave girl, had obviously never had a baby. Her body was still perfect. Jay would make her pregnant, sooner or later. But then he might drop her the way he had dropped Lizzie, and take up with yet another woman. Was that how he wanted to live his life? Were all men like that? Lizzie wished she could ask her mother. She was being treated as something used up, no good anymore, like a worn pair of shoes or a cracked plate. That made her angry. The baby who had grown inside her and made her belly bulge and stretched her vagina was Jay's child. He had no right to reject her afterwards. She sighed. It was pointless to get angry with him. She had chosen him, and she had been a fool. She wondered if anyone would ever find this body attractive again. She missed the feeling of a man's hands running over her flesh as if he could never get enough. She wanted someone to kiss her tenderly and squeeze her breasts and press his fingers into her.
She could not bear the thought that it would never happen again. She took a deep breath, pulling in her stomach and sticking out her chest. There, that was almost how she had looked before the pregnancy. She weighed her breasts, then touched the hair between her legs, and toyed with the button of desire. The door opened. Mac had to repair a broken tile in the fireplace in Lizzie's room. He had said to Mildred, "Is Mrs. Jamieson up yet?" Mildred had replied,
"Just gone over to the stables."
She must have thought he said Mr. Jamieson. All of that went through his mind in a split second. Then he thought of nothing but Lizzie. She was achingly beautiful. As she stood in front of the mirror, he could see her body from both sides. Her back was to him, and his hands itched to stroke the curve of her hips. In the mirror he could see the swell of her round breasts and the soft pink nipples. The hair at her groin matched the wild dark curls of her head. He stood there speechless. He knew he should mutter an apology and get out fast, but his feet seemed clamped to the floor. She turned to him. Her face was troubled, and he wondered why. Unclothed, she seemed vulnerable, almost afraid. At last he found his voice.
"Oh, but you're beautiful," he whispered.
Her face changed, as if a question had been answered.
"Close the door," she said.
He pushed the door behind him and crossed the room in three strides. A moment later she was in his arms. He crushed her naked body to him, feeling her soft breasts against his chest. He kissed her lips, and her mouth opened to him immediately. His tongue found hers, and he gloried in the wetness and hunger of her kiss. As he got hard, she pulled his hips to her and rubbed herself against him. He broke away, panting, afraid he would come right away. She tugged at his waistcoat and his shirt, trying to get beneath the clothes to his skin. He threw the waistcoat aside and pulled the shirt over his head. She bent her head and put her mouth to his nipple. Her lips closed over it in a kiss. Then she licked it with the tip of her tongue, and finally she bit it lightly with her neat front teeth. The pain was exquisite, and he gasped with pleasure.
"Now do it to me," she said.
She arched her back, offering her breast to his mouth. He lifted her breast in his hand and kissed the nipple. It was hard with desire. He savored the moment.
"Not so gently," she whispered.
He sucked fiercely, then bit her as she had bitten him. He heard her sharp intake of breath. He was afraid of hurting her soft body, but she said,
"Harder, I want it to hurt."
And he bit down.
"Yes,"
she said, and she pulled his head to her, so that his face squashed her breast. He stopped because he was afraid he would draw blood. When he straightened up, she bent to his waist, tugged on the string that held up his breeches, and pulled them down. His penis sprang free. She took it in both hands and rubbed it against her soft cheeks and kissed it. The pleasure was overwhelming, and once again Mac broke away from her, not wanting it to end too soon. He looked at the bed.
"Not there," Lizzie said. "Here."
She lay back on the rug in front of the mirror. He knelt between her legs, feasting his eyes.
"Now, quickly," she said.
He lay on top of her, resting his weight on his elbows, and she guided him inside. He gazed at her lovely face. Her cheeks were flushed, and her mouth was slightly open, showing moist lips and small teeth. Her eyes were wide, staring at him as he moved above her.
"Mike,"
she moaned.
"Oh, Mac."
Her body moved with his, and her fingers dug hard into the muscles of his back. He kissed her and moved gently, but once again she wanted more. She took his lower lip between her teeth and bit down. He tasted blood.
"Go faster,"
she said frantically, and her desperation took him over, and he moved faster, pushing inside her almost brutally, and she said,
"Yes, like that."
She closed her eyes, giving herself up to the sensation, and then she cried out. He put his hand over her mouth to quiet her, and she bit his finger hard. She pulled his hips to hers as hard as she could and twisted beneath him, her cries muffled by his hand, her hips rising to his again and again, until at last she stopped and sank back, exhausted. He kissed her eyes and her nose and her chin, still moving gently inside her. When her breathing eased and she opened her eyes, she said,
"Look in the mirror."
He looked up at the cheval glass and saw another Mac on top of another Lizzie, their bodies joined at the hip. He watched his penis move in and out of her body.
"It looks nice," she whispered.
He looked at her. How dark her eyes were, almost black.
"Do you love me?" he said. "Oh, Mac, how could you ask?"
Tears came to her eyes.
"Of course I do. I love you. I love you."
And then, at last, he came. When the first of the tobacco crop was at last ready for sale, Lennox took 4 hogsheads into Fredericksburg on a flatboat. Jay waited impatiently for him to come back. He was eager to know what price the tobacco would fetch. He would not get cash for it. That was not the way the market worked. Lennox would take the tobacco to a public warehouse where the official inspector would issue a certificate saying it was merchantable. Such certificates, known as tobacco notes, were used as money throughout Virginia. In time, the last holder of the note would redeem it by handing it to a ship's captain in exchange for money or, more likely, goods imported from Britain. The captain would then take the note to the public warehouse and exchange it for tobacco. Meanwhile, Jay would use the note to pay his most pressing debts. The smithy had been quiet for a month because they had no iron to make tools and horseshoes. Fortunately, Lizzie had not noticed that they were broke. After the baby was born dead, she had lived in a daze for 3 months. Then, when she caught him with Felia, she had become furiously silent. Today she was different again. She looked happier, and she seemed almost friendly.
"What's the news?"
she asked him at dinner. "Trouble in Massachusetts," he replied. "There's a group of hotheads called the Sons of Liberty. They've even had the nerve to send money to that damned fellow John Wilkes in London."
"I'm surprised they even know who he is."
"They think he stands for freedom. Meanwhile, the customs commissioners are afraid to set foot in Boston. They've taken refuge aboard HMS Rumney."
"It sounds as if the colonists are ready to rebel."
Jay shook his head. "They just need a dose of the medicine we gave the coal heavers, a taste of rifle fire and a few good hangings." Lizzie shuddered and asked no more questions. They finished the meal in silence. While Jay was lighting his pipe, Lennox came in. Jay could see that he had been drinking as well as doing business in Fredericksburg. "Is all well, Lennox?"
"Not exactly," Lennox said in his habitual insolent tone. Lizzie said impatiently, "What's happened?"
Lennox answered without looking at her.
"Our tobacco has been burned. That's what's happened."
"Burned?"
said Jay.
"How?"
said Lizzie.
"By the inspector. Burned as trash. Not merchantable."
Jay had a sickening feeling in the pit of his stomach. He swallowed and said,
"I didn't know they could do that."
Lizzie said,
"What was wrong with it?"
Lennox looked uncharacteristically flustered. For a moment he said nothing.
"Come on, out with it," Lizzie said angrily.
"They say it's cowpen," Lennox said at last.
"I knew it," Lizzie said.
Jay had no idea what they were talking about.
"What do you mean, cowpen? What's that?"
Lizzie said coldly,
"It means cattle have been penned on the land where the crop was grown. When land is over-manured, the tobacco acquires a strong, unpleasant flavor."
Jay said angrily,
"Who are these inspectors who have the right to burn my crop?"
"They're appointed by the House of Burgesses," Lizzie told him.
"It's outrageous. They have to maintain the quality of Virginia tobacco."
"I'll go to law over this,"
Lizzie said.
"Jay, instead of going to law, why don't you just run your plantation properly? You can grow perfectly good tobacco here if only you take care."
"I don't need a woman to tell me how to manage my affairs," he shouted.
Lizzie looked at Lennox.
"You don't need a fool to do it either," she said.
A terrible thought struck Jay.
"How much of our crop was grown this way?"
Lennox said nothing.
"Well?"
Jay persisted. Lizzie said,
"All of it."
Then Jay understood that he was ruined. The plantation was mortgaged, he was in debt up to his ears, and the entire tobacco crop was valueless. Suddenly he found he could hardly breathe. His throat seemed constricted. He opened his mouth like a fish, but he could get no air. At last he drew breath, like a drowning man coming to the surface for the last time.
"God help me,"
he said, and he buried his face in his hands. That night he knocked on Lizzie's bedroom door. She was sitting by the fire in her nightdress, thinking about Mac. She was ecstatically happy. She loved him, and he loved her. But what were they going to do? She stared into the flames. She tried to be practical, but all the time her mind drifted into remembering how they had made love, here on the rug in front of the cheval glass. She wanted to do it again. The knock startled her. She jumped out of her chair and stared at the locked door. The handle rattled, but she had locked the door every night since she caught Jay with Felia. Jay's voice came,
"Lizzie, open this door."
She said nothing.
"I'm going to Williamsburg early in the morning to try to borrow more money," he said. "I want to see you before I go."
Still she said nothing.
"I know you're in there, now open up."
He sounded a little drunk. A moment later there was a thud, as if he had thrown his shoulder against the door. She knew that would not achieve anything. The hinges were brass and the bolt was heavy. She heard his footsteps recede, but she guessed he had not yet given up, and she was right. 3 or 4 minutes later he came back and said,
"If you don't open the door, I'm going to break it down."
There was a bang as something crashed into the door. Lizzie guessed he had fetched an axe. Another crash split the woodwork, and she saw the blade come through. Lizzie began to feel scared. She wished Mac was nearby, but he was down in the slave quarters, sleeping on a hard bunk. She had to take care of herself. Feeling shaky, she went to her bedside table and picked up her pistols. Jay continued to attack the door, his axe smashing into the woodwork with a series of deafening crashes, splintering the timber and causing the walls of the wood-frame house to tremble. Lizzie checked the loading of the pistols. With an unsteady hand, she poured a little gunpowder into the priming pan of each. She released the safety catches on the flintlocks and cocked them both. "I don't care now," she thought fatalistically. "What will be, will be." The door flew open and Jay burst in, red-faced and panting. With the axe in his hand, he stepped towards Lizzie. She stretched out her left arm and fired a shot over his head. In the confined space, the bang was like a cannon. Jay stopped and held up his hands in a defensive gesture, looking scared.
"You know how straight I can shoot," she said to him. "But I've only got one shot left, so the next will go into your heart."
As she spoke, she could hardly believe she was tough enough to say such violent words to the man whose body she had loved. She wanted to cry, but she gritted her teeth and stared unflinchingly at him.
"You cold bitch," he said.
It was a clever barb. Coldness was what she accused herself of. Slowly she lowered the pistol. Of course she would not shoot him.
"What do you want?" she said.
He dropped the axe.
"To bed you one time before I leave," he said.
She felt sick. The image of Mac came into her mind. No one but he could make love to her now. The thought of doing it with Jay was horrifying. Jay grasped her pistols by the barrels, and she let him take them away. He uncocked the one she had not fired, then dropped both. She stared at him in horror. She could not believe this was going to happen. He came close and punched her in the stomach. She let out a cry of shock and pain and doubled up.
"Never point a gun at me again," he yelled.
He punched her face, and she fell to the floor. He kicked her head, and she passed out. Chapter 35. All the next morning, Lizzie lay in bed with a headache so severe she could barely speak. Sarah came in with breakfast, looking frightened. Lizzie sipped some tea, then closed her eyes again. When the cook came to take the tray away, Lizzie said,
"Is Mr. Jamieson gone?"
"Yes, madam. He left for Williamsburg at first light. Mr. Lennox gone with him."
Lizzie felt a little better. A few minutes later, Mac burst into the room. He stood beside her bed and stared at her, shaking with rage. He reached out and felt her face with trembling fingers. Although her bruises were tender, his touch was light and he did not hurt her. In fact, she found it comforting. She took his hand and kissed his palm. They sat together for a long time, not speaking. Lizzie's pain began to ease. After a while, she fell asleep. When she woke up, he had gone. In the afternoon, Mildred came in and opened the blinds. Lizzie sat up while Mildred combed her hair. Then Mac came in with Dr. Finch.
"I didn't send for you," Lizzie said.
Mac said, "I fetched him." For some reason, Lizzie felt ashamed of what had happened to her, and she wished Mac had not gone for the doctor.
What makes you think I'm sick?
You spent the morning in bed.
I might just be lazy,
and I might be the governor of Virginia. She relented and smiled. He cared for her, and that made her happy.
I'm grateful, she said.
The doctor said,
I was told you had a headache. I'm not ill, though, she replied.
What the hell, she thought. Why not tell the truth?
My head hurts because my husband kicked it.
Finch looked embarrassed. How's your vision? Blurred?
No.
He put his hands on her temples and probed gently with his fingers.
Do you feel confused? Love and marriage confuse me, but not because my head's damaged. Ouch!
Is that where the blow landed?
Yes, damn it. You're lucky to have so much curly hair. It cushioned the impact.
Any nausea?
Only when I think about my husband.
She realized she was sounding brittle.
But that's no concern of yours, Doctor. I'll give you a drug to ease the pain. Don't get too fond of it. It's habit-forming. Send for me again if you have any trouble with your eyesight.
When he had gone, Mac sat on the edge of the bed and held her hand. After a while, he said,
If you don't want him to kick your head, you should leave him.
She tried to think of a reason why she should stay. Her husband did not love her. They had no children, and it seemed they never would. Their home was almost certainly forfeit. There was nothing to keep her.
I wouldn't know where to go, she said.
I would.
His face showed profound emotion.
I'm going to run away.
Her heart missed a beat. She could not bear the thought of losing him.
Peg will go with me,
he added. Lizzie stared at him, saying nothing.
Come with us, he said.
There, it was out. He had hinted at it before. Run away with some ne'er-do-well, he had said. But now he was not hinting. She wanted to say,
Yes, yes, today, now.
But she held back. She felt frightened.
Where will you go?
She said. He took from his pocket a leather case and unfolded a map.
About 100 miles west of here is a long mountain range. It starts way up in Pennsylvania and goes farther south than anyone knows. It's high, too. But people say there's a pass called the Cumberland Gap down here where the Cumberland River rises. Beyond the mountains is wilderness. They say there aren't even any Indians there because the Sioux and the Cherokee have been fighting over it for generations and neither side can get the upper hand long enough to settle.
She began to feel excited.
How would you get there?
Peg and I would walk. I'd head west from here to the foothills. Pepper Jones says there's a trail that runs southwest, roughly parallel with the mountain range. I'd follow that to the Holston River, here on the map, then strike out into the mountains.
And if you were not alone?
If you come with me, we can take a wagon and more supplies, tools, seed and food. I won't be a runaway then. I'll be a servant, travelling with his mistress and her maid. In that case, I'd go south to Richmond, then west to Staunton. It's longer, but Pepper says the roads are better. Pepper could be wrong, but it's the best information I've got.
She felt scared and thrilled.
And once you reach the mountains?
He smiled.
We'll look for a valley with fish in the stream and deer in the woods, and perhaps a pair of eagles nesting in the highest trees. And there we'll build a house.
Lizzie packed blankets, woolen stockings, scissors, needles and thread. As she worked, her feelings seesawed from elation to terror. She was deliriously happy at the thought of running away with Mac. She imagined them riding through the wooded country side by side and sleeping together in a blanket under the trees. Then she thought of the hazards. They would have to kill their food day by day, build a house, plant corn, doctor their horses. The Indians might be hostile. There could be desperadoes roaming the territory. What if they got snowed in? They could starve to death. Glancing out of her bedroom window, she saw the buggy from McLean's Tavern in Fredericksburg. There was luggage on the back and a single figure in the passenger seat. The driver, an old drunk called Simmons, had obviously come to the wrong plantation. She went down to redirect him. But when she stepped out onto the porch, she recognized the passenger. It was Jay's mother, Alicia. She was wearing black.
Lady Chamerson, Lizzie said in horror. You should be in London.
Hello, Lizzie, said her mother-in-law. Sir George is dead. Heart failure, she said a few minutes later, sitting in the drawing room with a cup of tea. He collapsed at his place of business. They brought him to Grosvenor Square, but he died on the way. There was no sob in her voice, no hint of tears in her eyes as she spoke of the death of her husband. Lizzie remembered the young Alicia as pretty rather than beautiful, and now there was little remaining of her youthful allure. She was just a middle-aged woman who had come to the end of a disappointing marriage. Lizzie pitied her. I'll never be like her, she vowed. Do you miss him? She said hesitantly. Alicia gave her a sharp look. I married wealth and position, and that's what I got. Olive was the only woman he loved, and he never let me forget it. I don't ask for sympathy. I brought it on myself, and so I bore it for 24 years. But don't ask me to mourn him. All I feel is a sense of release. That's dreadful, Lizzie whispered. Such a fate had been on the cards for her, she thought with a shiver of dread. But she was not going to accept it. She was going to escape. However, she would have to be wary of Alicia. Where's Jay? Said Alicia. He's gone to Williamsburg to try to borrow money. The plantation hasn't prospered then. Our tobacco crop was condemned. The shadow of sadness crossed Alicia's face. Lizzie realized that Jay was a disappointment to his mother, just as he was to his wife, though Alicia would never admit it. I suppose you're wondering what's in Sir George's will, Alicia said. The will had not crossed Lizzie's mind. Did he have much to bequeath? I thought the business was in trouble. It was saved by the coal from Hyde Lane. He died a very rich man. Lizzie wondered whether he had left anything to Alicia. If not, she might expect to live with her son and daughter-in-law.
Did Sir George provide for you?
Oh, yes. My portion was settled before we married, I'm happy to say. And Robert has inherited everything else.
That's what we all expected. But my husband left a quarter of his wealth to be divided among any legitimate grandchildren alive within a year of his death. So your little baby is rich? When am I going to see him? Or her? Which did you have?
Alicia had obviously left London before Jay's letter arrived.
A little girl, Lizzie said. How nice. She's going to be a rich woman. She was born dead.
Alicia offered no sympathy.
Hell, she swore.
You must be sure to have another, quickly. Mac had loaded the wagon with seed, tools, rope, nails, cornmeal and salt. He had opened the gun room with Lizzie's key and taken all the rifles and ammunition. He had also loaded a ploughshare. When they reached their destination, he would convert the wagon into a plough. He would put 4 mares in the traces, he decided, and take 2 stallions in addition so that they could breed. Jay Jamieson would be furious at the theft of his precious horses. He would mind that more than the loss of Lizzie, Mac felt sure. While he was roping down the supplies, Lizzie came out.
"Who's your visitor?" he asked her.
"Jay's mother, Alicia."
"Good God, I didn't know she was coming."
"Nor did I."
Mac frowned. Alicia was no threat to his plans, but her husband might be.
"Is Sir George coming?"
"He's dead."
That was a relief.
"Praise be. The world has well rid of him."
"Can we still leave?"
"I don't see why not. Alicia can't stop us."
"What if she goes to the sheriff and says we've run away and stolen all this?"
She indicated the pile of supplies on the wagon.
"Remember our story. You're going to visit a cousin who has just started a farm in North Carolina. You're taking gifts,
even though we're bankrupt.
Virginians are famous for being generous when they can't afford it." Lizzie nodded.
"I'll make sure Colonel Thompson and Susie Delahay hear of my plans. Tell them that your mother-in-law disapproves, and she may try to make trouble for you."
"Good idea. The sheriff won't want to get involved in a family quarrel."
She paused. The look on her face made his heart race. Hesitantly, she said,
When shall we leave?"
He smiled. "Before first light. I'll have the wagon taken down to the quarters tonight, so that we won't make much noise as we go. By the time Alicia wakes up, we'll be gone." She squeezed his arm quickly, then hurried back into the house. Mac came to Lizzie's bed that night. She was lying awake, full of fear and excitement, thinking of the adventure that would begin in the morning, when he came silently into the room. He kissed her lips, threw off his clothes, and slipped into bed beside her. They made love, then lay talking in low voices about tomorrow, then made love again. As dawn approached, Mac drifted into a doze, but Lizzie stayed awake, looking at his features in the firelight, thinking of the journey in space and time that had brought them from Hyde Len all the way to this bed. Soon he stirred. They kissed again, a long, contented kiss. Then they got up. Mac went to the stables while Lizzie got ready. Her heart raced as she dressed. She pinned her hair up and put on breeches, riding boots, a shirt and a waistcoat. She packed a dress she could quickly slip on if she needed to revert to being a wealthy woman. She was frightened of the journey they were about to take, but she had no qualms about Mac. She felt so close to him that she would trust him with her life. When he came for her, she was sitting at the window in her coat and three-cornered hat. He smiled to see her in her favorite clothes. They held hands and tiptoed down the stairs and out of the house. The wagon was waiting by the road, out of sight. Peg was already sitting on the seat, wrapped in a blanket. Jimmy, the stable boy, had put four horses in harness and roped two more to the back. All the slaves were there to say goodbye. Lizzie kissed Mildred and Sarah, and Mac shook hands with Kobe and Cass. Bess, the field hand who had been injured on the night Lizzie lost her baby, threw her arms around Lizzie and sobbed. They all stood silent in the starlight and watched as Mac and Lizzie climbed on the wagon. Mac cracked the reins and said, "Hup! Walk on!" The horses took the strain, the wagon jerked, and they moved off. At the road, Mac turned the horses in the direction of Fredericksburg. Lizzie looked back. The field hands were standing in complete silence, waving. A moment later, they were gone from sight. Lizzie looked ahead. In the distance, dawn was breaking. End of side 17. Side 18. Chapter 36. Matthew Murchman was out of town when Jay and Lennox reached Williamsburg. He might be back tomorrow, his servant said. Jay scribbled a note saying he needed to borrow more money and he would like to see the lawyer at his earliest convenience. He left the office in a bad temper. His affairs were in a complete mess and he was impatient to do something about it. Next day, forced to kill time, he went along to the red and grey brick Capitol building. Dissolved by the governor last year, the assembly had reconvened after an election. The Hall of Burgesses was a modest, dark room with rows of benches on either side and a kind of sentry box for the speaker in the middle. Jay and a handful of other observers stood at the back, behind a rail. He swiftly realized that the colony's politics were in turmoil. Virginia, the oldest British settlement on the continent, seemed ready to defy its rightful king. The Burgesses were discussing the latest threat from Westminster. The English Parliament was claiming that anyone accused of treason could be forced to return to London to stand trial under a statute that dated back to Henry VIII. Feelings ran high in the room. Jay watched in disgust as one respectable landowner after another stood up and attacked the king. In the end, they passed a resolution saying that the treason statute went contrary to the British subject's right to trial by a jury of his peers. They went on to the usual gripes about paying taxes while having no voice in the Westminster Parliament. "No taxation without representation," was their parrot cry. This time, however, they went farther than usual and affirmed their right to cooperate with other colonial assemblies in opposition to royal demands. Jay felt sure the governor could not let that pass, and he was right. Just before dinner time, when the Burgesses were discussing a lesser, local topic, the sergeant-at-arms interrupted the proceedings to call out, "Mr. Speaker, a message from the governor." He handed a sheet of paper to the clerk, who read it and said, "Mr. Speaker, the governor commands the immediate attendance of your house in the council chamber." Now they're in trouble, Jay thought with relish. He followed the Burgesses as they trooped up the stairs and through the passage. The spectators stood in the hall outside the council chamber and looked through the open doors. Governor Bottetourt, the living embodiment of the iron fist in the velvet glove, sat at the head of an oval table. He spoke very briefly. "I have heard of your resolves," he said. "You have made it my duty to dissolve you. You are dissolved accordingly." There was a stunned silence. "That will be all," he said impatiently. Jay concealed his glee as the Burgesses slowly filed out of the chamber. They collected their papers downstairs and drifted into the courtyard. He made his way to the Rowley Tavern and sat in the bar. He ordered his midday meal and flirted with a barmaid who was falling in love with him. As he waited, he was surprised to see many of the burgesses go past, heading for one of the larger rooms in the rear. He wondered if they were plotting further treason. When he had eaten, he went to investigate. As he had guessed, the burgesses were holding a debate. They made no attempt to hide their sedition. They were blindly convinced of the rightness of their cause, and that gave them a kind of mad self-confidence. "Don't they understand," Jay asked himself, "that they're inviting the wrath of one of the world's great monarchies? Do they suppose they can get away with this in the end? Don't they realize that the might of the British army will sooner or later wipe them all out?" They did not, evidently, and so arrogant were they that no one protested when Jay took a seat at the back of the room, although many there knew he was loyal to the crown. One of the hotheads was speaking, and Jay recognized George Washington, a former army officer who had made a lot of money in land speculation. He was not much of an orator, but there was a steely determination about him that struck Jay forcibly. Washington had a plan. In the northern colonies, he said, leading men had formed associations whose members agreed not to import British goods. If Virginians really wanted to put pressure on the London government, they should do the same. "If ever I heard a treasonable speech," Jay thought angrily, "that was it." His father's enterprise would suffer further if Washington got his way. As well as convicts, Sir George shipped cargoes of tea, furniture, rope, machinery, and a host of luxuries and manufactures that the colonists could not produce themselves. His trade with the North was already down to a fraction of its former worth. That was why the business had been in crisis a year ago. Not everyone agreed with Washington. Some burgesses pointed out that the northern colonies had more industry and could make many essentials for themselves, whereas the south depended more on imports. "What will we do," they said, "without sewing thread or cloth?" Washington said there might be exceptions, and the assembly began to get down to details. Someone proposed a ban on slaughtering lambs to increase the local production of wool. Before long, Washington suggested a small committee to thrash out the technicalities. The proposal was passed, and the committee members were chosen. Jay left the room in disgust. As he passed through the hall, Lennox approached him with a message. It was from Murchman. He was back in town, he had read Mr. Jamieson's note, and he would be honoured to receive Mr. Jamieson at 9 o'clock in the morning. The political crisis had distracted Jay briefly, but now his personal troubles came back to him and kept him awake all night. At times he blamed his father for giving him a plantation that could not make money. Then he would curse Lennox for over-manuring the fields instead of clearing new land. He wondered if his tobacco crop had in fact been perfectly all right, and the Virginian inspectors had burned it just to punish him for his loyalty to the English king. As he tossed and turned in the narrow bed, he even began to think Lizzie might have willed the stillborn child to spite him. He got to Murchman's house early. This was his only chance. No matter where the fault lay, he had failed to make the plantation profitable. If he could not borrow more money, his creditors would foreclose the mortgage, and he would be homeless as well as penniless. Murchman seemed nervous.
"I've arranged for your creditor to come and meet you," he said.
"Creditor? You told me it was a syndicate."
"Ah, yes. A minor deception, I'm sorry. The individual wanted to remain anonymous."
"So why has he decided to reveal himself now?"
I couldn't say."
"Well, I suppose he must be planning to lend me the money I need. Otherwise, why bother to meet me?"
"I dare say you're right. He hasn't confided in me."
Jay heard a knock at the front door and low voices as someone was admitted. "Who is he, anyway?"
"I think I'll let him introduce himself."
The door opened, and in walked Jay's brother, Robert. Jay leaped to his feet, astonished. "You," he said. "When did you get here?" "A few days ago," Robert said. Jay held out his hand, and Robert shook it briefly. It was almost a year since Jay had seen him last, and Robert was getting more and more like their father, beefy, scowling, curt. "So it was you who loaned me the money?" Jay said. "It was father," Robert said.
"Thank God! I was afraid I might not be able to borrow more from a stranger."
"But father's not your creditor any more," Robert said. "He's dead."
"Dead?"
Jay sat down again abruptly. The shock was profound. Father was not yet 50.
How?
Heart failure. Jay felt as if a support had been pulled away from beneath him. His father had treated him badly, but he had always been there, consistent and seemingly indestructible. Suddenly the world had become a more insecure place. Although he was already sitting down, Jay wanted to lean on something. He looked again at his brother. There was an expression of vindictive triumph on Robert's face. Why was he pleased? There's something else, Jay said. What are you looking so damn smug about? I'm your creditor now, Robert said. Jay saw what was coming. He felt as if he had been punched in the stomach.
You swine, he whispered.
Robert nodded. I'm foreclosing on your mortgage. The tobacco plantation is mine. I've done the same with High Glen, bought up the mortgages and foreclosed. That belongs to me now. Jay could hardly speak.
You must have planned this,
he said with a struggle. Robert nodded. Jay fought back tears.
You and father?
Yes.
I've been ruined by my own family.
You've been ruined by yourself. You're lazy and foolish and weak. Jay ignored his insults. All he could think of was that his own father had plotted his downfall. He remembered how the letter from Merchman had come just a few days after his arrival in Virginia. Father must have written in advance, ordering the lawyer to offer a mortgage. He had anticipated that the plantation would get into difficulties, and he had planned to take it back from Jay. His father was dead, but had sent this message of rejection from beyond the grave. Jay stood up slowly, with a painful effort, like an old man. Robert stood silent, looking scornful and haughty. Merchman had the grace to act guilty. With an embarrassed look on his face, he hurried to the door and held it for Jay. Slowly, Jay walked through the hall and out into the muddy street. Jay was drunk by dinner time. He was so drunk that even Mandy, the barmaid who was falling in love with him, appeared to lose interest. That evening, he passed out in the bar of the Raleigh. Lennox must have put him to bed, for he woke up in his room the following morning. He thought of killing himself. He had nothing to live for, no home, no future, no children. He would never amount to anything in Virginia now that he had gone bankrupt, and he could not bear to go back to Britain. His wife hated him, and even Philia now belonged to his brother. The only question was whether to put a bullet into his head or drink himself to death. He was drinking brandy again at 11 o'clock in the morning when his mother walked into the bar. When he saw her, he thought perhaps he was already going mad. He stood up and stared at her, frightened. Reading his mind, as always, she said, "No, I'm not a ghost." She kissed him and sat down. When he recovered his composure, he said,
"How did you find me?"
"I went to Fredericksburg, and they told me you were here. Prepare yourself for a shock. Your father's dead."
"I know."
That surprised her.
"How?"
"Robert is here."
"Why?"
Jay told her the story and explained that Robert was now the owner of both the plantation and High Glen.
"I was afraid the two of them were planning something like that," she said bitterly.
"I'm ruined," he said. "I was thinking of killing myself." Her eyes widened.
"Then Robert didn't tell you what was in your father's will."
Suddenly Jay saw a gleam of hope.
"Did he leave me something?"
"Not you, no. Your child." Jay's heart sank again.
"The child was stillborn.
A quarter of the estate goes to any grandchildren of your father born within a year of his death. If there are no grandchildren after a year, Robert gets everything."
"A quarter? That's a fortune.
All you have to do is make Lizzie pregnant again." Jay managed to grin.
"Well, I know how to do that anyway."
"Don't be so sure. She's run away with that coal miner."
"What?"
"She left with McCash."
"Good God! She's left me, and gone off with a convict."
It was deeply humiliating. Jay looked away.
"I'll never live this down. Good God!
That child is with them, Peggy Knapp. They took a wagon and 6 of your horses, and enough supplies to start several farms."
"Damn thieves!"
He felt outraged and helpless.
"Couldn't you stop them?"
"I tried," the sheriff, "but Lizzie had been clever. She gave out a story that she was taking gifts to a cousin in North Carolina. The neighbors told the sheriff I was just a cantankerous mother-in-law trying to stir up trouble."
"They all hate me because I'm loyal to the king."
The seesaw of hope and despair became too much for Jay, and he sank into lethargy. "It's no good," he said. "Fate is against me."
"Don't give up yet."
Mandy, the barmaid, interrupted to ask Alicia what she would like. She ordered tea. Mandy smiled coquettishly at Jay.
"I could have a child with another woman," he said as Mandy went away.
Alicia looked scornfully at the barmaid's wiggling rear and said, "No good. The grandchild has to be legitimate."
"Could I divorce Lizzie?"
"No, it requires an act of Parliament and a fortune in money, and anyway we don't have the time. While Lizzie is alive, it has to be her."
"I've no idea where she's gone."
"I do." Jay stared at his mother. Her cleverness never ceased to amaze him.
"How do you know?"
"I followed them." He shook his head in incredulous admiration.
"How did you do that?"
"It wasn't difficult. I kept asking people if they had seen a four-horse wagon with a man, a woman, and a child. There's not so much traffic that people forget."
"Where did they go?"
"They came south to Richmond. There they took a road called Three Notch Trail and headed west, towards the mountains. I turned east and came here. If you leave this morning, you'll be only 3 days behind them." Jay thought about it. He hated the idea of chasing after a runaway wife. It made him look such a fool. But it was his only chance of inheriting. And a quarter of father's estate was a huge fortune. What would he do when he caught up with her?
"What if Lizzie won't come back?" he said.
His mother's face set in grim lines of determination.
"There is one other possibility, of course," she said.
She looked at Mandy, then turned her cool gaze back on Jay. "You could make another woman pregnant, and marry her, and inherit, if Lizzie suddenly died." He stared at his mother for a long moment. She went on, "They're headed for the wilderness, beyond the law. Anything can happen out there. There are no sheriffs, no coroners. Sudden death is normal, and no one questions it." Jay swallowed dryly and reached for his drink. His mother put her hand on the glass to prevent him. "No more," she said. "You have to get started." Reluctantly, he withdrew his hand. "Take Lennox with you," she advised. "If the worst comes to the worst, and you can't persuade or force Lizzie to come back with you, he will know how to manage it." Jay nodded.
"Very well," he said. "I'll do it."
Chapter 37. The ancient buffalo hunting track, known as Three Notch Trail, went due west for mile after mile across the rolling Virginia landscape. It ran parallel to the James River, as Lizzie could see from Mac's map. The road crossed an endless series of ridges and valleys formed by the hundreds of creeks that trickled south into the James. At first they passed many large estates, like the ones around Fredericksburg, but as they went further west, the houses and fields became smaller and the tracts of undeveloped woodland larger. Lizzie was happy. She was scared and anxious and guilty, but she could not help smiling. She was out of doors, on a horse, beside the man she loved, beginning a great adventure. In her mind she worried about what might happen, but her heart sang. They pushed the horses hard, for they feared they might be followed. Alicia Jamison would not sit quietly in Fredericksburg waiting for Jay to come home. She would have sent a message to Williamsburg or gone there herself to warn him of what had happened. Were it not for Alicia's news about Sir George's will, Jay might have shrugged his shoulders and let them go. But now he needed his wife to provide the necessary grandchild. He would almost certainly chase after Lizzie. They had several days' start on him, but he would travel faster, for he had no need of a wagon load of supplies. How would he follow the fugitive's trail? He would have to ask at houses and taverns along the way, and hope that people noticed who went by. There were few travellers on the road, and the wagon might well be remembered. On the third day, the countryside became more hilly. Cultivated fields gave way to grazing, and a blue mountain range appeared in the distant haze. As the miles went by, the horses became overtired, stumbling on the rough road and stubbornly slowing down. On uphill stretches, Mac, Lizzie, and Peg got off the wagon and walked to lighten the load, but it was not enough. The beasts' heads drooped, their pace slowed further, and they became unresponsive to the whip.
"What's the matter with them?" Mac asked anxiously.
"We have to give them better food," she replied. "They're existing on what they can graze at night. For work like this, pulling a wagon all day, horses need oats."
"I should have brought some," Mac said regretfully. "I never thought of it. I don't know much about horses."
That afternoon they reached Charlottesville, a new settlement growing up where Three Notch Trail crossed the north-south Seminole Trail, an old Indian route. The town was laid out in parallel streets rising up the hill from the road, but most of the lots were undeveloped, and there were only a dozen or so houses. Lizzie saw a courthouse with a whipping post outside, and a tavern identified by an inn sign with a crude painting of a swan.
"We could get oats here," she said.
"Let's not stop," Mac said. "I don't want people to remember us." Lizzie understood his thinking. The crossroads would present Jay with a problem. He would have to find out whether the runaways had turned south or continued west. If they called attention to themselves by stopping at the tavern for supplies, they would make his task easier. The horses would just have to suffer a little longer. A few miles beyond Charlottesville, they stopped where the road was crossed by a barely visible track. Mac built a fire and Peg cooked hominy. There were undoubtedly fish in the streams and deer in the woods, but the fugitives had no time for hunting and fishing, so they ate mush. There was no taste to it, Lizzie found, and the glutinous texture was disgusting. She forced herself to eat a few spoonfuls, but she was nauseated, and she threw the rest away. She felt ashamed that her field hands had eaten this every day. While Mac washed their bowls in a stream, Lizzie hobbled the horses so that they could graze at night but not run away. Then the three of them wrapped themselves in blankets and lay under the wagon, side by side. Lizzie winced as she lay down, and Mac said, "What's the matter?"
"My back hurts," she said. "You're used to a feather bed. I'd rather lie on the cold ground with you than sleep alone in a feather bed."
They did not make love, with Peg beside them, but when they thought she was asleep, they talked, in low murmurs, of all the things they had been through together.
"When I pulled you out of that river and rubbed you dry with my petticoat," Lizzie said. "You remember?"
"Of course. How could I forget? I tried your back, and then when you turned around..."
She hesitated, suddenly shy.
"You had got excited."
"Very. I was so exhausted I could hardly stand. But even then I wanted to make love to you.
I'd never seen a man like that before. I found it so thrilling. I dreamed about it afterwards. I'm embarrassed to remember how much I liked it."
"You've changed so much. You used to be so arrogant."
Lizzie laughed softly.
"I think the same about you."
"I was arrogant? Of course. Standing up in church and reading a letter out to the laird."
"I suppose I was.
Perhaps we've both changed."
"I'm glad we have."
Mac touched her cheek.
"I think that was when I fell in love with you, outside the church, when you told me off. I loved you for a long time without knowing it. I remember the prize fight. Every blow that landed on you hurt me. I hated to see your beautiful body being damaged. Afterwards, when you were still unconscious, I caressed you. I touched your chest. I must have wanted you even then, before I got married. But I didn't admit it to myself. I'll tell you when it started for me. Down the pit, when you fell into my arms, and I accidentally felt your breast and realized who you were."
She chuckled.
"Did you hold me a bit longer than you really needed to?"
He looked bashful in the firelight.
"No. But afterwards I wished I had. Now you can hold me as much as you like."
"Yes."
He put his arms around her and drew her to himself. They lay silent for a long while, and in that position they went to sleep. Next day they crossed a mountain range by a pass, then dropped down into the plain beyond. Lizzie and Peg rode the wagon downhill while Mac ranged ahead on one of the spare horses. Lizzie ached from sleeping on the ground, and she was beginning to feel the lack of good food. But she would have to get used to it. They had a long way to go. She gritted her teeth and thought of the future. She could tell that Peg had something on her mind. Lizzie was fond of Peg. Whenever she looked at the girl, she thought of the baby who had died. Peg had once been a tiny baby, loved by her mother. For the sake of that mother, Lizzie would love and care for Peg.
"What's troubling you?"
Lizzie asked her.
"These hill farms remind me of Burgo Marlowe's place."
It must be dreadful, Lizzie thought, to have murdered someone. But she felt there was something else, and before long Peg came out with it.
"Why did you decide to run away with us?"
It was hard to find a simple answer to that question. Lizzie thought about it, and eventually replied,
"Mainly because my husband doesn't love me any more, I suppose."
Something in Peg's expression made her add,
"You seem to wish I had stayed at home." "Well, you can't eat our food, and you don't like sleeping on the ground, and if we didn't have you, we wouldn't have the wagon, and we could go faster." "I'll get used to the conditions, and the supplies on the wagon will make it a lot easier for us to set up home in the wilderness."
Peg still looked sulky, and Lizzie guessed there was more to come. Sure enough, after a silence, Peg said,
"You're in love with Mac, aren't you?" "Of course. But you've only just got rid of your husband. Isn't it a bit soon?"
Lizzie winced. She herself felt this was true in moments of self-doubt. But it was galling to hear the criticism from a child.
"My husband hasn't touched me for 6 months. How long do you think I should wait? Mac loves me."
This was becoming complicated.
"He loves us both, I think," Lizzie said. "But in different ways."
Peg shook her head.
"He loves me. I know it. He's been like a father to you, and I'll try to be like a mother, if you'll let me."
"No,"
Peg said angrily.
"That's not how it's going to be."
Lizzie was at a loss to know what to say to her. Looking ahead, she saw a shallow river with a low wooden building beside it. Obviously, the road crossed the river by a ford just here, and the building was a tavern used by travellers. Mac was tying his horse to a tree outside the building. She pulled up the wagon. A big, roughly dressed man came out wearing buckskin trousers, no shirt, and a battered three-cornered hat.
"We need to buy oats for our horses," Mac said.
The man replied with a question.
"You folks going to rest your team and step inside to take a drink?"
Suddenly, Lizzie felt a tankard of beer was the most desirable thing on earth. She had brought money from Mockjack Hall, not much, but enough for essential purchases on the journey.
"Yes,"
she said decisively, and she swung down from the wagon.
"I'm Barney Tobold. They call me Baz," said the tavern keeper.
He looked quizzically at Lizzie. She was wearing men's clothing, but she had not completed the disguise, and her face was obviously female. However, he made no comment, but led the way inside. When her eyes adjusted to the gloom, Lizzie saw that the tavern was one bare, earth-floored room with two benches and a counter and a few wooden tankards on a shelf. Baz reached for a rum barrel, but she forestalled him, saying,
"No rum, just beer, please."
"I'll take rum,"
Peg said eagerly.
"Not if I'm paying, you won't," Lizzie contradicted her. "Beer for her too, please, Baz."
He poured beer from a cask into wooden mugs. Mac came in with his map in his hand and said,
"What river is this?"
"We call it South River.
Once you cross over, where does the road lead to?"
"A town called Staunton, about 20 miles away. After that, there's not much. A few trails, some frontier forts. Then rail mountains that nobody's ever crossed. Where are you people headed, anyway?"
Mac hesitated, so Lizzie answered,
"I'm on my way to visit a cousin."
"And Staunton?"
Lizzie was flustered by the question.
Near there."
"Is that so? What name?"
She said the first name that came into her head.
"Angus. Angus James."
Baz frowned.
"That's funny. I thought I knew everyone in Staunton, but I don't recognize that name."
Lizzie improvised.
"It may be that his farm is some way from the town. I've never been there.